Be here and to see this beautiful new courthouse for the first time. My name is Gary Craw and I represent the Space Village Parties. I will be referring to the other parties as Lac Loggia for the sake of ease and expedition. I'd like to start by pointing out a few key facts in the case. This is a case about a series of mud floods from the Lac Loggia property, which was uphill from the Space Village mini warehouse property. And these mud floods occurred while the Lac Loggia property was in the process of being developed. The floods started in the summer of 2007 and continued through the summer of 2008 whenever there was heavy rain until the lot was ultimately paved in accordance with the drainage and development plan. Now, the first time there was a mud flood, the wall collapsed and 40 to 50 of my clients' Space Villages, mini storage units, which are like a garage, were flooded with mud. They lost customers and revenue, and after the second summer of mud floods, they lost the family business and foreclosure to the bank. And that's how this case was started. The bank started the foreclosure proceeding. First, some key testimony from the engineer for Lac Loggia and the development of their uphill property. Mr. Oliver Watts, their engineer, testified that Lac Loggia did not comply with his drainage plan. His plan called for four 12-inch drainage pipes to channel runoff onto paved surface that would then drain the water off to a holding pond. Lacca instead put in two 6-inch pipes and a single 4-inch pipe. Now, I asked Mr. Watts at trial, is that, you know, two 6-inch pipes for drainage equivalent to a 12-inch, and of the record of 24, 14 through 16, he said no. They only provide half of the drainage capacity. Mr. Watts also testified at 24, 35, 36 that some of the drain pipes Lacca put in on their property were not even functional. They were raised above the level of the ground. Lacca did not use native vegetation to try to hold the dirt in place during construction. And when they built a shell building, they had the downspouts from all the water that landed on the roof pointed straight south downhill at my client's Space Village.
Sorry for interrupting you, but as you could see from the previous case, we had lots of questions about that case. We have lots of questions about this one. And you can certainly make your argument in any manner you would like to, but I would like to hear about the jury instruction on duty to mitigate damages, which is one of your claims.
Yes, sir.
And would you address that, please, as to why you think that instruction was erroneously given?
Certainly. That instruction is erroneous, Your Honor, because basically it elevated mere factual arguments of Lacca to repetitive ways of saying the same thing, but turned it into an instruction of law for the jury. It was repetitive, it was four pages in length. It highlighted fact arguments of Lacca about what were disputed issues of fact. Now, the law, as I've cited in the reply on page 8, is that jury instructions must not be argumentative, must not highlight or emphasize specific evidence, must not be repetitious or restate one side's evidence, and most importantly, must be a correct statement of the law to the jury.
Why isn't this a correct statement of the law to the jury? This, I think it was 21 or 22?
Right. Because under Burt versus Beautiful Savior, that was a very similar case where the trial court found it was no error for the trial, or the, excuse me, Court of Appeals found it was no error for the trial court not to give a failure to mitigate instruction in a flooding case, and said the law imposes no duty on a plaintiff to anticipate illegal acts of trespass or negligence, or such as trespass and negligence, and the plaintiff has no duty to anticipate that his neighbor's acts or omissions would result in flooding. That's at 1068 and 1069 in the Burt opinion. And they make it clear that fact arguments are one thing, and they're for closing argument. But when you're dealing with an instruction of law, It's got to stay, there has to be some, well, let me back up. When you're dealing with a failure to mitigate obstruction, the general rule is that, you know, did they take reasonable steps to mitigate their damages? If you're going to use something more specific than that, the instructions on use and the case law say that there has to be a specific legal duty so that the court is not put in the position of submitting, as a jury instruction of law, a factual argument.
Which of these many paragraphs do you contend instructs the jury on something that is not a legal duty? In other words, do you object
yes.
to all of these? Which ones are these?
Well, it's so long, I won't have time to object to all of them, but let me answer your question by saying this, Your Honor. If you look at 1G, 1I, and 1J, all three of those say that Space Village failed to loan funds to LAC, and one says funds to stop the mud flows, the next one says, that was G rather, I says funds to pave to stop the mud flows,
okay.
1J says loan funds to stop the mud after Space Village was no longer a part owner.
Your position is there was no duty to loan funds to their neighbor to fix this property.
That's right, and they've cited no case law in the trial court nor before this court that supports that.
But weren't there some inter-entity relationships?
Indeed.
Between the Space Village property owners or
indeed, Space Village owned precisely 50% of the Lackalosia company. So they did not have a majority interest where they could say, we're going to take charge here and see that these things are fixed. They had to have 1% more, and they didn't have it. And to compound the situation and make it worse, the managing partner of Lackalosia, Mr. Whitney, ultimately excluded the Space Village owners, 50% owners, from any of the management decisions in Lackalosia, and that's on record in the transcript. And further, said, you know, you can't come onto the property and do this. So I know I'm facing an argument, why didn't your people go onto their neighbor's property uphill and fix the problem? Well, they didn't have a legal right to do that, and they were excluded, even though they were partial minority owners of the property.
And it's my recollection that the jury awarded the Space Village claimants $6,000 or so.
So just under $7,000.
Under $7,000. Was there any way to, anything in the record that would indicate how the jury applied the failure to mitigate offset to reach that amount?
Well, we don't know what went on in deliberations, but the $6,000 to $7,000 roughly correlates with the expense to rebuild the wall after it first collapsed in 2007, which was a hard item of expenses that the jury was handed in exhibits and was clear on the record. As to how they applied the failure to mitigate instruction with 15 different ways of saying essentially three things, as my opponent's brief has referred to it, and I forget the page of his brief, but he summarized it and only came up with three different ways of failure to mitigate. But there was 15 of them, so there's no way to know exactly how the jury applied those 15 different things, but what we do know is that the instruction told them damages caused by a failure to mitigate cannot be awarded. This is instruction 38. This defense is proven if the plaintiff failed to do any of the following, and then listed 15 different things, many of which are repetitive and different ways of saying the same thing.
Let me ask you this question, Mr. Croft. If we were to accept your argument regarding instruction number 21, or I think it's 22, isn't it?
I'm with you.
Yes. If we were to accept your argument, what would be your remedy? What should we do?
Well, I think the fairly recent Supreme Court case of the one that abolished sudden emergency defense, before it got to that, said, an instruction is not harmless if it is faulty and could affect the outcome. And here, I think it goes right to the heart of the case. We had a case where there was probably $2 to $3 million worth of damages, and the jury returned $7,000. Now, the reason they did that is because they literally applied that failure to mitigate instruction and used all those things to whittle it down to, in at least in my view, the cost, the hard cost and receipt for the rebuilding of the wall. Did that answer your question?
Well, did I? There were two claims, the way I understand it. There was a negligence claim and there was a trespass claim. And the jury found no liability on the trespass claim.
That's right.
No trespass. And they found no liability for Mr. Whitten on the negligence claim. Liability for Wakwoja?
Yes.
Wakwoja on the negligence claim. So liability was determined.
Oh, the remedy.
What's the remedy if we were to agree with your assessment of the instruction?
To remand it for trial on damages with negligence having been found against Wakwoja, and for the jury to determine damages based on proper instruction on failure to mitigate. And or, I should say, entry of judgment on trespass as a matter of law, even though the jury went against that. If you look at all the cases I've cited in trespass, the intentional element was not properly defined by the judge. She referred only to it being an affirmative act, whereas the case law shows that if there's snow on the roof and you don't remove it and it falls down on your neighbor's property, that's an omission. That's trespass. The Lowry landfill case, the Howry case that I cited, and there's the same thing. If you let toxic chemicals seep into the ground and don't do anything to prevent that, and they go onto your adjoining landowner's property and cause damage, that's trespass. It's not an affirmative act. It's an omission. And if you look at instruction 22, the way the judge worded that instruction, and it's not written exactly like the stock, there has to have been an act that was committed. Specifically, she wrote that a person intentionally causes mud flows if it's their purpose to cause the mud flows, or when it is it or his purpose to do an act that in the natural course of events results in intrusion. And what I had submitted as an alternative to that is number tendered instruction 2, which basically said that can be an act or omission, so it would be clear to the jury in the case, because an act by definition is not an omission.
Well,
and the jury, I think, needed clarification on that.
Isn't an omission almost always preceded by an act? I mean,
well,
the omission of not cleaning off the snow, which fell on someone else's roof, was preceded by the construction of the building in that manner.
Indeed, an omission is preceded by a deliberate choice.
And you argued here that these were deliberate choices, didn't you? That they built the building without the proper drainage, they didn't put in the proper grass.
Indeed, and that's why I think you can enter judgment directly on the trespass.
Well, but the jury found against you. Having made that argument, they found that there was no trespass. I don't know why, but that's what the record shows.
Yes. But I think you raised a very strong point. I just lost my train of thought for a second, Your Honor, and I apologize for that.
My point is that you suggest that the result might have been different had the instruction said for an omission. Judge Hawthorne's point is an omission is preceded by an act, and certainly in this case, we're not talking about strictly an omission. You argued, and there was evidence of affirmative, arguably negligent, and maybe acts that resulted in trespass.
Right. They pointed the drain spout south towards
the right. I understand. So the jury came out against you on that. So I'm not sure how it would make it. We would think it would make any difference that included, even if it was required, to include the word omission in the instruction, given the fact that you had acts, you argued acts, the judge instructed acts. And by the way, she instructed right out of 18.2. I disagree with your characterization. It says the act.
I'm sorry, I didn't think it was verbatim. I thought she
almost
should have changed that. But, you know, we as lawyers assume that people know that acts are something and include omissions. But in the vernacular among people, jurors that decide these kinds of cases, they don't know that. They, to them, an act is an affirmative thing. You do something.
But I think,
the omission is when you don't do something.
Yeah, but I think Judge Richman's point was, why isn't this harmless error, since you argued acts at length? Based on your introductory statement, you had ample evidence of acts. You know, the two 6-inch pipes versus the 12-inch. You still lost. So
because
why?
Jury may not have agreed with me on the act part of it.
Well, did
but
you?
But if they had been instructed that you can also consider decisions to omit taking steps, then the jury might have agreed with me.
And did you argue that to the jury?
I hope I argued everything, but I can't honestly remember at this point.
Did you? That's a fair answer. I apologize. Did you put in evidence of omissions? I mean, things that they should, that a reasonable owner should have done that they didn't do.
I believe so. Yes, that they, you know, didn't do the, they didn't follow the drainage plan of Ollie Watts that I started with.
Okay, understood. All right.
I believe I've got 40 seconds, and I'm
no, you're underwater 40 seconds.
Oh, okay. I apologize for taking up extra time, Your Honors. Yeah. Thank you. Again, it was my honor to appear before you in this beautiful courthouse.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Frank Patterson, registration 12058, on behalf of the La Calogia parties. And I'll start with the failure to mitigate instruction. I think our brief fully covered the undisclosed damages arguments. If you have any questions about that, I'd be happy to argue, but I'll go directly to the failure.
I do have one, but you don't have to answer it now. Let's assume, I'm not asking you to waive any of your positions, that we reverse on the instruction issue and remand for a new trial. Doesn't that give the lower court ample opportunity to reopen discovery, allow, well, I guess as a practical matter, as the plaintiff here, to augment the designation? You can take more discovery if you want, and the damages issue goes away.
It might, but that was the option they had at the time that this problem first arose. At pursuant to the Todd v. Bear Valley case, if in fact plaintiff decided that the damages were important and there was a ruling against him on prejudice and the lack of disclosure and inexcusable for the failure to disclose, they could have sought a continuance of the trial in order to correct those errors. Not having done so, they shouldn't be given a second opportunity to the prejudice of the defending party to do it, saying, oh, we wanted one bite of the apple to see how it would go at trial. Then having lost that, we'd like this court to give us that second bite because we didn't take our option for a continuance at that time.
Thank you. And I apologize for interrupting. So go on with the mitigation.
Sure. No problem. Mitigation instruction does, in fact, state the law. The legal elements of that instruction follow the jury instruction, the stock jury instruction, telling the jury what the law is, which is that a party has an obligation to mitigate or minimize their damages. It also states the true law, which is the burden is upon the party asserting failure to mitigate to establish the elements of that. There's nothing misleading about those statements of law. The failure to mitigate instruction, however, does require inclusion of factual comments, much like 2:1, the statement of the case instruction. And as the court instructs the jury in every case, nothing I say by these instructions and nothing I have done during the course of this case is supposed to give you any hint that I have an opinion as to what the facts of the case are or what has or has not been proven. So much like the statement of the case that sets forth the elements of the party's claims and defenses, the failure to mitigate instruction requires a factual recitation to let the jury determine whether the asserting party has proven the failure to mitigate. Now, there are 15, and that's a lot for a failure to mitigate instruction, different elements in there, but not one of those did plaintiff at the time object as a false statement of a defense. Plaintiff just said that they were duplicative or that they were argumentative, but he never said at the time of the trial that these are a false statement of a duty owed. In fact, plaintiff in their brief for the claiming party, the Space Village Party, say in their appellate brief that these are all things that could have been argued. They just shouldn't have been in the jury instruction because it misleads the jury into thinking that this is a statement of facts that the judge believes. And that's not the case. If Space Village parties agree that Laka Loja could have argued all of these, which they did at the time of trial and in their brief now, if they could have argued it, then it's harmless error. Because, as the previous question was, aren't they all things that the defendant could have argued as a reason to mitigate at the time of trial, which is in fact what they did?
I appreciate that you're making a sort of a waiver argument, but let's go a step beyond that. Can you cite us to any law or any provision in the Lac Loja LLC agreement that would impose an obligation on members to make loans to the LLC so that the LLC could do something?
I don't have the name of a case, but the members of an organization have an affirmative fiduciary or quasi-fiduciary duty to preserve the assets of the LLC. And even though they are a 50% owner and may not have had management control of it, they have that affirmative duty to preserve and protect their own investment.
Well, that it's a pretty general statement, but I'm not going to argue with you. Can you point to any kind of authority, treatises, anything that says that requires a member of an LLC to loan money to the LLC?
Not to loan. I can't.
Well, that was one of your instructions. I mean, that was one of the bases for the mitigation instruction, was failure to loan.
Failure to loan, which is another way of saying take measures to preserve, which was at a significant portion of time, your asset, your property. And if you look at the record, the jurors submitted a number of questions on that topic, which is, what did you do to preserve it? What did you do?
Okay, I'll try to be more precise in my question, but let's try to keep the entities separate. Are you saying that the law imposes an obligation on the Space Village people who are also members of the LLC to make loans to Lac Loja because they're members of LLC of Lac Loja, or it imposes on them an obligation to loan money to Lac Loja simply to protect their own property? I mean, I think it's asked, well, I don't know if it has to be one or the other, but answer those questions separately.
Right. The first one I would say that I don't have any law on. The second one, I think there is good law that you preserve your investment, you preserve your property.
Okay, so we've carved out their status as Lac Loja limited partners, whatever they were. So you're saying that if I'm downhill from a house and the water's running off of that house and wrecking my yard, I have an obligation to go to the uphill owner and say, I'm sorry, you're unemployed, I'll lend you $10,000 to re-landscape your property and put up a retaining wall to protect me?
You have a duty to take steps that are reasonable. And remember, every single one of these elements, the judge by herself added the language as a reasonable person would have done under the circumstances. So it becomes a fact question whether the jury could conclude it would have been reasonable for the Space Village parties to take that step.
Doesn't it seem kind of anomalous, though, to say that the innocent party has to go to the tortfeasor and say, I will lend you money so that you stop committing torts that impact my property?
That may be at the far extreme of what a person could or should do.
You think yes. any case that's ever held something like that in the context of failure to mitigate?
Not off the top of my head, but as I go, if I think of one, I'll let you know. But the purpose of the mitigation instruction is saying there is an ongoing damage. You are currently suffering a loss. You have an obligation to take steps that are reasonable to stop that loss or to minimize the damages. One of those could be that you put up a wall on your property.
That I agree with.
Right, and that's a conservative one. Another one might be a conservative approach. Go to the neighbor and say, do whatever it takes, lock the loads. You do whatever it takes to stop the water. That's another reasonable step. Another one might be to take the excavating equipment that you have and dig a trench and preserve your property. But another one might also be, hey, look, Lockaloja, I know you don't have the resources to do this. We've got a joint problem. You've got this water running down onto my property. I'm the one suffering losses. I've got the resources. I think I can help both of us out here. Now, again, the jury had to make a factual determination. Was that a reasonable step?
Excuse me, counsel, I'm going to interrupt you at that point because I have a question just about that. You said the jury had to make a determination whether or not that would be what a reasonable person would do. And I understand you to say that the judge added the language as a reasonable person would have done under the same or similar circumstances. By doing that, in this instruction, does not this instruction do just the opposite? It doesn't set up a factual question for the jury to decide, but it usurps from the jury's province the determination of that factual question by saying, I'm looking at F. Mm-hmm. Contribute funds to Lockaloja while claimants were half owners, etc., as a reasonable person would have done under the same or similar circumstances. That seems to me that the judge of this instruction is telling the jurors, this is what a reasonable person would have done.
Well, I disagree that it can only be read that way. It's a matter of how you put an emphasis on that clause. As you said it, as a reasonable person would have done. Whereas we read it as, a reasonable person would have done under the same or similar circumstances. The judge's, the intent of that and the stock instruction is to tell the jury that you have to determine whether it was reasonable under the circumstances. I think you're reading it, Judge Hawthorne, is saying, the judge is saying as a reasonable person would have done under these circumstances.
That's the way it appears to me.
Isn't the stock instruction where it says to insert that language, I agree with you, the stock instruction suggests to insert that clause. But isn't that talking about a situation where the person has a legal duty to do what is going to be inserted in the stock instruction? I think the example is go to see a doctor when you've been injured, right. Something like that.
Well, to an extent, the legal duty is to mitigate. The legal duty is not to go to a doctor. To go to a doctor is one of the factual ways you can mitigate. That's where the confusion is in the briefing and in our arguments right now, is that the duty legally is to mitigate. You don't have a duty to go to a doctor every single time. It's if under these circumstances that would have been the reasonable thing to do.
But I think the difference is in Judge Richmond's example, the doctor isn't the tortfeasor. You're not going to the doctor to stop the tort from recurring. You're going to the doctor to lessen your harm by getting prudent medical treatment. In your example, loaning money to Lockaloja so that Lockaloja can make improvements on its property is to stop the tortfeasor from committing the tort again. And I apologize if I seem argumentative, but it's incomprehensible to me that the victim of a recurring tort has to go to the tortfeasor and loan money, which if they're insolvent is probably the equivalent of giving it away, but to fund action of the tortfeasor that will stop the tort.
Well, let's see if I can help. What's bothering you is that you're thinking of the tortfeasor continuing to commit an affirmative act that causes the damage. So in your mind, it's almost like the guy in the car continuing to hit the innocent victim.
Well, not necessarily. It's the guy in the case that your opponent referred to that doesn't shovel snow off his roof until it slides off and hits the house next door.
Okay. But if you look at it slightly differently,
so we'll just take that. I mean, the mountain communities all have services that will shovel roofs. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we all know that. Okay, so you're saying that if on the downhill house, and I can see the snow getting 5, 10, 15 feet high on the next roof, and I know the guy's out of work and is impoverished,
I have an obligation to mitigate my damages by going to him and saying, can I pay somebody to shovel the roof off for you?
No, you don't have
an obligation. How is that different from what's going on here?
Because the jury has to decide whether that's reasonable under the circumstances or not.
How could
it's an element that if the jury believes that you should have done that and you could have solved your problem, that's a factual determination. In our brief, we cite to the Colorado case law that says, what constitutes a reasonable effort in mitigation is a question of fact for the jury to decide.
Okay, so you're saying that there is no legal limitation on what a jury might find would be reasonable.
No, I always avoid saying there's no limitation whatsoever. I think you keep coming back to, is there a legal duty? And I'm saying no, don't start with legal duty. Start with the only legal duty we're talking about is to mitigate or minimize your damages reasonably under the circumstances. You don't have to have a legal duty to go to your neighbor and say, I'll pay to shovel your roof. What you have to do is mitigate or minimize your damages, and if you see that and you can convince a jury that, or if the other side can convince a jury you should have paid to clean my roof, that's reasonable under the circumstances. The court purposefully let the jury decide what is reasonable under the circumstances. Just like Metropolitan Gas versus Kulig, the court can act as a gatekeeper in some respects, but it's always a fact question as to what is negligence. And it's always a fact question as to what is reasonable in terms of mitigation. The plaintiff the claiming parties certainly stand up and say, as you did, why should I pay for my neighbor to have something constructed on his property? Well, if that's the best and most reasonable means to prevent further damage, that's argument. That's a fact question. And what you're starting with is thinking that it's a duty. I have a duty to go.
I appreciate the distinction.
I want to ask just one more question. I know we're over time, but because you're saying don't start with a legal duty, don't start with an affirmative duty. Are you familiar with the recent case of this court, Banning versus Prester? The 2012 case where Judge Casebolt reviews whether or not the plaintiff had a duty to mitigate by ceasing to obtain medical treatment when it was expensive and failed to resolve the complaint of pain. Have you read that case?
Well,
I know it's very
recent. Not since I read it in the advance sheets or advance online.
I mean, in that case, Judge Casebolt says the parties have not cited nor have we found any Colorado case law or cases from other jurisdictions holding that a plaintiff has an affirmative duty to cease medical treatment when it is expensive and fails to resolve complaint of pain. That seems to me that this division at least has started with
the duty.
The duty.
Right, and I think that's the improper analysis. I mean, I go back to the Bedore versus Johnson, which is the Supreme Court case in January that abolished the sudden emergency defense, which I argued the wrong side of that case. But the court there said there was no factual support in the record for the instruction. That differs from what we have here with the failure to mitigate, because there was factual support in the evidence for all of the elements of this instruction. The only question now is whether it is a duty, you start with a duty, or if it's a factual determination but for the jury to discern.
Okay, I appreciate your answering Judge Hawthorne's question. Your time is exhausted. As with the prior counsel, we appreciate your patience in responding to the many questions. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course.